So being a devotee means that one is absorbed in Krishna. So being absorbed in Krishna means the body, the mind, the words are engaged in Krishna's service. So the words means the intelligence, because the intelligence is the lord of the senses. So this means then everything, the gross and subtle body are engaged in the Lord's service. So not to do that means the consciousness, of course, has to be connected, has to be engaged. So the idea is that somehow or another one should see in all aspects of life that one is connected to Krishna. Now of that, then of course, the direct activities of devotional service are important, right? You're chanting the holy name, hearing Bhagavatam, the association of devotees, worshipping the deity, living in the holy place. These are your prominent aspects. So these are what we would call direct devotional service. So the devotee, of course, makes a focal point on these. But depending upon one's situation, and even otherwise, there's only so much time that one is engaged in these direct activities. And then the rest of the time, it's about engaging the indirect. It's what's not automatically connected with the Lord. In other words, chanting the holy name is Krishna, whether you're aware of it or not. Right? It's not that if you're not aware of Krishna, then he's not there. When you're aware of Krishna, he's there, right? Because then that would make you in control of Krishna, dependent upon your thinking of it. No. The holy name is Krishna, whether we understand it or appreciate it or not. So that's why, then, if one's aware, it's considered better, and if one's not aware, it's considered less good, because you are directly giving to Krishna. And it's same with Prasad, same with the deity. So that's the point. The direct activities means it's directly Krishna. Now, indirect means everything else that you're dealing with within Krishna's creation. And so those elements, then if you connect them, Krishna's there. Of course, Krishna's there in his potencies. Right? Krishna's potencies are in everything. The wind's blowing from Krishna's potency. It's not that the air element blows by nature. No. Krishna's created that the nature of air is to move, but that's because his potency is making the air do that. Right? Otherwise, air is dead matter. It doesn't really have too much of a worry. Right? The air couldn't care less if it's moving or not. Right? It's not that it's thinking that only if I move, then this is nice. Right? So, but this is all happening on the Brahman platform. Right? Because impersonal means doesn't mean void. That's the Mayavadi's concept. Impersonal means not specific, you know, personally applied. Like if I say greatness, right? It's a quality. Right? But this quality of greatness is impersonal. Does that make sense? Because it's generic and it can be applied anywhere. So when we apply it to Krishna's pastimes, and he does something great there, so greatness is manifest, then it's personal. You understand? But otherwise, the quality of greatness is just part of Krishna. Krishna is all of the superior qualities. It's just a matter of which one is manifested at any particular time. So when it's in connection with his pastimes with the devotees, that's personal. When it's not, that's impersonal. You understand? So this understanding of impersonal is not a problem. Because that's how we say Krishna is all-pervading. Right? But it's not that the Bhagavan is himself pervading everything. His nature is that he is pervading everything. That's that's his existence. He pervades everything. But he's doing that as Brahman. Right? Brahman means transcendence. Right? So Krishna is pervading everything. So then the point is that one will be in material consciousness or mundane consciousness as long as one doesn't see how Krishna is involved in everything. Right? But he doesn't personally is not there unless you think of him in connection with that. Because otherwise, the impersonalist can also see Brahman everywhere. Right? So they're in contact with Krishna as Brahman. But they're not in contact with Krishna as the Bhagavan. Right? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like we hear, we were discussing this morning, that we hear, you know, so many of the followers of the Vedic culture, they practice Naishkarma, which means karma without attachment to the result. So then it will be called Naishkarmya, Nishkam Karma Yoga, Karma Yoga, all these different aspects will be called. So many different ashrams and this, they follow this. But in doing so, yes, they are performing their duties and without a desire for result, at least so they say. So we'll take it on that platform. They're saying they're performing it without desire for result. So it's Naishkarmya. But the benefit of Naishkarmya means you're performing your duties, but that duty is not being performed with a fruit of desire, so it doesn't create any material result. Right? So if that practice is constant, then it brings one to the platform of liberation. Huh? Okay. So then the devotee is doing Naishkarmya. But the point is that result is for Krishna. That's how it's Naishkarmya. He doesn't want it for himself, but he wants it for Krishna. So that means the devotee is automatically doing things to please Krishna at the same time he's doing them not to please himself. Does that make sense? So in other words, the direct application is Krishna consciousness. The indirect is liberation. Right? Does that make sense? So the devotee is automatically liberated because the process of liberation is already contained within devotional service. The impersonalists simply follow half of the devotional process. That's all. Right? In other words, there's no potency other than Krishna that's going to make anything happen. Right? So the point is whether you want to deal with Krishna in this position of energetic devotionally or just as existence. Right? So now that means then for the materialist, he's looking at the world around him and all the energy and activities that go on, but he's not thinking that there's something beyond this dead matter that makes it alive, makes it interesting, makes it attractive. He thinks that whatever I see, that in itself is what's attractive. Right? The nice mowed green lawn, he thinks it's the green grass that is attractive. It's Krishna's potency in the grass that's attractive. Right? Does that make sense? So one person looks at the mowed lawn and they think, nice, because it's organized, it's neat, it's aesthetic. It means somebody's made some endeavor. So that's what's attractive. Those are the qualities of Krishna that are present in that grass. But we think the grass is the attractive feature. When it's not, it's actually Krishna. Well, someone else isn't so attracted by that. They like the natural field, right? Because it's nature and it's natural. Right? And you know, it has its own beauty. But that naturalness, that particular beauty, that's still Krishna. Because otherwise, you're just dealing with more dead matter. Dead matter is not attractive to the soul who is conscious. Right? Something unconscious is not attractive to something conscious. So in other words, what's making the unconscious attractive is Krishna. So the materialist doesn't understand this. They think it's matter, so that's why they're materialists. Right? Because for them, it's about matter. Right? But now for someone in knowledge, then they understand it's not the matter. It's actually the potency behind that, it's Brahman. So then they're transcendentalists because they see the transcendental. They see that what's behind the material is actually spiritual. But that's all the more they know. They only know Brahman is all-pervading. So they appreciate that. Right? Does that make sense? We're talking here Brahmanandis. Maya bodies, you know, don't even count this conversation because they're not that intelligent. Right? So the But beyond this, the point is this Brahman is the effulgence of Krishna's qualities. So just the effulgence of Krishna's qualities makes all this happen, and it looks so attractive. Right? So then let alone the person that it comes from. So now, for the devotee, when they're dealing with Brahman, they're always dealing with part of Brahman, because they're dealing with the person from whom Brahman comes. So the devotee never just thinks of Brahman. They start from that element of Brahman and think of Krishna, the person. Right? Then Krishna, the person, is who you're interacting with, even though you're interacting through the medium of Brahman, because Brahman and Krishna are the same. Does that make sense? So that means all the indirect activities are connected to the Lord. Otherwise, devotees have so much difficulty. Well, how do I connect my life outside the temple to Krishna? But the point is it's only connected to Krishna. Right? It's a matter of finding Krishna there. We're thinking Krishna's only in direct activities. He's also in indirect. Because he's what makes it work. Why work? Why does somebody work? They just like going down and volunteering at some place and just doing the work. He loves sitting in that, it's just the wonderfulness of that little sterile cubicle that you sit in, you know, behind the computer with all the papers around and all the other annoying people in the office and the coffee machine and water machine that doesn't work, right? Isn't that why you just every morning get up and I just want to be there, right? And so it doesn't matter, you know, all the traffic, whatever it takes. It's windy, it's cold, it's hot. You're going to get there and you're going to appreciate, right? Isn't that why everyone goes to work? No? No. So why does anybody go to work? Money, right? Yeah. This means these aren't trick questions. So it's money. Right? So, but the point is then when they give you that money, what does the money look like? Huh? Little flat pieces of plastic, right? You know, with faces on them. Right? That's at best, money times is just little numbers on a computer. Yeah. Right? So you don't even really know if it exists. You hope it exists, everybody else thinks it exists. So it works out. But if any large group of people start not having faith that that exists, your stock market falls. You ever notice when they go down like that? That means at that moment no one has faith in the system. That's what it is. And when it's going up means they have faith in the system. It's scarily that simple. That's all it is. But because the materialist understands that economics is a driving force in human society, therefore they can bank on it that you will want it. Right? And if there is something goes on, then there's a temporary thing. That's why nowadays they know, okay, if it starts to fall, you pump a little money into the market and then keep it afloat until the mood comes up again. Right? Otherwise, in the last, let's say, 10 years, the crashes in the market have been worse than the 1920s crash. Or no, 29 crash. You know, they completely wiped out everything. But because they know the system now, then they just know how to keep it going. Right? Does that make sense? So in other words, it's just people having that faith in it. But the point is that eternal principle of economics, that's not what's created by the economic community. That's created by Krishna. Right? So this thing, then people have faith in, they know that will remain, just like people will have desire, people will have need, people will be active, people have an identity. Right? So that's what they take advantage of to make money. No? You have an identity. So, yeah, you have this and it's prestigious. Or you have this, you'll be sporty, or you'll be cool, or you understand, or you'll enjoy. You understand? So they know that these things, but the problem is they don't know that that's Krishna. So therefore, materialism. Right? The yogi understands this is Krishna's potency. It's not material energy. Material energy doesn't have the potency to attract a living entity. Right? Maya is given that potency by Krishna. Therefore, she can control it. Otherwise, what means super soul has to sanction it first. Then the potency is there. Does that make sense? And Maya knows what to do with the potency. But it's not that the shadow doesn't have potency over what's solid, right? It's not that you're standing there and then you have to worry that, you know, your shadow's going to bite somebody or something like that. Right? Isn't it? You don't send your shadow over to grab somebody and stuff. No, it doesn't have that potency. Right? Or do you have that problem? You don't have that problem. Just make sure. Just in case. Unless you know something that we don't know. Been hanging out in New Orleans too long or something. Okay, so then the point is that the devotee, he understands that all these aspects of the life, like going to work, the economic element, that's Krishna. Then you can do something with that, right? You can use it to maintain the family, but maintenance is Krishna. You can give it in charity. Charity is Krishna. Does that make sense? Whatever it is you're looking for, you want the health of your family, the Krishna's health. You want the happiness of your family, Krishna's happiness. The problem is we think it's the forms of this world that are causing all those qualities. So for the devotee, he works with those positions and generates those qualities based on his duties. Right? Because one may say, well, if it's all that, then why we should do anything? But the point is how are you going to interact with Krishna except through forms and activities? Right? That's the principle. The principle is the living entity in their position serves Krishna. Right? Now, in the spiritual world, that position happens to be spiritual, you know, with a spiritual form. Right? You're dealing with in superior energy. So whatever you're dealing with is spiritual. But still the principle is the same. Depending upon your position, you engage that in Krishna's service. Right? Well, in the material world, then you have a conditioned nature. So you follow the same principle. Engage your position in Krishna's service. So whatever your conditioning is, that's what you connect to Krishna. Does this make sense? Right. So that's how one then sees Krishna in everything. So that's the indirect. Right? So Krishna is recommending in the second canto that the directly and indirectly, both ways, you see Krishna. Now, if you can sit at work, doing your work, and think of Krishna and Vrindavan as pastimes all day, great. And they'll pay you for that, that's even better. Right? But if not, then you have to deal with the indirect. Right? So that's the principle. So therefore, all the activities of the body are connected. All the mind and the intelligence are all connected to the Lord. Any questions on this? No? Once Prashad? Yes.
Yesterday you mentioned about like the living entity being dissolved to 110,000. How does, and you mentioned that this depends on desire and sanctioned by Krishna and then it moves man. How does it exactly work?
How does it exactly work that the living entity moves matter? The living entity doesn't move matter, so the living entity simply desires. Means the simple element is the soul desires, right? And that desire means you're working with desire as part of what's called prajumna. So it's part of the relationship, sambandha, in the knowledge. So that means the field that you're working in, then the living entity is observing the field. So you're doing that through intelligence, and intelligence is the closest thing to the super soul. So therefore, through the intelligence, then the Lord sees what you desire. You know what I'm saying? It's just that you're desiring in that meaning. It means he's in the heart, so he knows what's happening. Then, according to previous karma, you know, or whatever your devotional position, then he sanctions that or not. If he sanctions it, then the material nature, through the modes of nature, material energy, means Maya Devi, through the modes, that's how she works, then she carries that out. Right? Whatever the medium happens to be. So that way the planets control things. Your life force, all these different things move. The air means that the desire, you know, therefore is pushing on the air. The air pushes on the fire pushes on the, you know, the muscle. And the muscle moves. But you don't do anything. You just desire. But because as you desire it happens, therefore then you get the idea that I'm doing it. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like, let's say, adults sometimes when they play with little kids, then the little kid does something, you know, swings their hand, and the adult goes falling backwards. So the kid thinks, I did that. But did they do that? No. So that's how it works. Right? Yeah, therefore the theory that adults are just big kids comes into play. Something else? Yes?
You mentioned the intelligence as the king of the senses.
How the senses work. The mind is why you do anything with the senses. But the actual control of the senses is the intelligence.
Now, obviously everyone's got different capacities to understand issues.
The main thing is that faith, and that you just see everything connected to Krishna. These are just various tools how you can deal with all these areas. So for someone, let's say, like what you're saying, they're very simple, you know, not that analytical, but they see everything in connection to Krishna. You know, now they're going to work, you know, so they have money to do things for Krishna, and this is their family, that they're engaging in Krishna's service, and like that, then it works very fine. So it's not based on that one have a certain volume, means a certain physical capacity or intellectual, emotional capacity. One has to have that faith. What we were discussing there is that sometimes we'll be brought up that, well, you know, we have to be practical because, you know, the devotional activities are there, and then we have to deal with the reality, you know, they use these terms, reality of material life, you know. The reality is only defined in spiritual. Material is only real when you understand the connection to spiritual. If you don't see the connection to spiritual, you're dealing with illusions. So using the term reality would be improper. But they try to use it because if I say, because we're, as devotees, then we're interested in knowledge, truth, reality. We use these terms on the spiritual platform. So if I throw them, you know, sprinkle them into my mundane concepts, it makes it look like it's spiritual, or at least it doesn't look so bad. Right. You know. In other words, if I say I'm being practical, it sounds good. If I say I'm very attached to family life and the facilities that are there, and I really, you know, have the need to work for them, and I have faith in Krishna consciousness, so I do the direct devotional activities of chanting and all that, and associate with devotees when I can. But I really need to work very hard to make money and take care of my family. And unfortunately, that takes most of my time. So yes, that's generally why I show up just on Janmashtami in time for prasad. You know? You understand? All that is packed into the word practical. You know? But that's real. So if you say it like that, then the problem is then there's the idea that the social prestige will drop. So you don't want to present it like that. You want to present it that you're an upstanding member of the community, so therefore you're being practical. Does that make sense? Like back in the 70s, they would have said it exactly the way I said it. And then everyone would go, yeah, you know, it happens, you know, it takes practice and this and that. Everybody would have been supportive. But now it's kind of like, I'm being practical, so out of my face, buzz off. You know, and then everybody wonders why there's no community. Hey. You know what I'm saying? So it's not actually reality, it's not actually truth. The real truth is the reason that we're involved within the world is our conditioning to the world. Now, the nice thing about Krishna consciousness, if you base it on the principles of duty, you know, which is a Vedic concept, then Whether you're attached to those, to that conditioning or not, you will still function within it. See, in the Vedic system, let's say the young man, he's gone to, you know, he's learned the knowledge of what material life is and spiritual life. But there's still that inclination towards family life. Right? So he'll get married and he'll have his family. Then as he practices that knowledge, he may come to the point of understanding or realizing that there is nothing in material life. But he continues doing his duties because the other members are still involved. The children are grown up, you know, everything's like this. So he continues his duties. So externally it looks exactly the same as someone who's attached. You know, until the time then, when you're 50, then you retire. Right? So the husband and wife, they don't get so much into the economic thing. They kind of retire and get more into the direct activities of devotional service. You know, let the kids, you know, play around with the material energy. Right? So then it works very naturally because it's duties. Problem is, if one doesn't function on duties in the Vedic principle, then one very enthusiastic goes into household life because he thinks there's actually something there. Then as he finds out there's nothing there, in other words, the knowledge comes into play, he compares it, oh, that's why I'm not happy because material life doesn't offer anything, then he drops his duties and he walks out of the family. You understand? It's not that he walks out and takes up preaching all over the world and all that. He just goes to a cave, does his own thing, but, you know, he just becomes independent. That's the material side. So that's why the Vedic principle focuses so much on duties, perform your duties, because then the social system works. And the fun part is that, you know, the materialistic mind wants the social system, the social interaction, all the nice social elements, but from the Western point of view, opposes the Vedic concept of duty. So whatever the duty is why do I have to do that? We're not the body, we can do anything we like. So if everybody does everything, then what do you have? You know what I'm saying? Let's say it's time for a festival, and if everybody just does whatever they like, is it just going to be a good festival? No. So that's the problem. Unless there's planning, unless there's, you know, positions into, like I remember, does that make sense? Right. So this is the fun part. We want one thing, but what is required to get it is then defined by the Vedic literatures, and that we oppose. And then we wonder why we don't get it. And then the fun part is generally they blame Krishna consciousness. Right? But it's like, who has followed the Vedic culture? Because if you follow it, it works. If you don't follow it, it doesn't work. Does that make sense? And as we said, since everything comes from Krishna, then the social concept, the social system, the family unit, economics, you know, enjoyment, all these things come from Krishna. They don't come from the Western society. It's not that they manufacture it. Right? Is it? You know, is there a country on the planet they specifically manufacture happiness or satisfaction or wealth or prestige or does that make sense? It's not. So all it is if you have faith in Krishna and that Krishna is involved in everything, whether you understand it or not, you have that faith. So therefore you function on that platform, especially if there's things that, you know, the scriptures have said to do and you recommend it, and you do them. Whether you understand how they mechanically work or not, you get the benefit. You know, it's just like that Brahmin, mentioned this morning, that Brahmin in South India, he didn't know how to read, but he had faith in the Gita and the teachings of Krishna to Arjuna. So he got the full benefit even though he can't read the book. Right? And the great scholars, they could read the book but didn't catch that point. So it's not based on, anything material. Bhakti is independent. So it simply requires faith. Faith is actually the system. Does that make sense? Yeah. That's why from the simplest to the most sophisticated, everybody can be involved. Yes, I
understand.
Yes.
Krishna tells Uddhava that the devotees are fooling the dust of my lotus feet. And then I am also calling the dust of the lotus feet of the devotees. Can you elaborate a little bit more? This shows that the devotee is naturally connected to Krishna. Krishna is not, you know, away from the devotee. That's what I feel.
But it means, but there's a doubt that Krishna is not connected with the devotees.
No.
But I'm saying, why would it come up that means Krishna is always means the devotees are very dear to Krishna, so Krishna is always involved with the devotees.
What my point I'm trying to make that the devotees is always connected to Krishna.
Yes. Okay. Yes. No. Devotees are always connected. All living entities are connected, but especially the devotees are connected. See, because Krishna deals with everybody according to how they deal with him. Right. So, for the materialist, if he just sees, you know, wealth or prestige, then Krishna only interacts with him as wealth or prestige. But he's still always involved with Krishna. But they just don't know that that's what's happening. But because the devotee recognizes that it's Krishna, therefore Krishna reciprocates with that. So it appears, so therefore the devotees get special favor. You know, but it's not going against the rules, but at the same time it's you know, they get that mercy because they recognize Krishna and want to be involved in the relationship. So therefore Krishna is involved with such devotees like that. Like you said. They're surrendered to Krishna, and Krishna is surrendered to them. Yes.
How do we understand the Nityananda and Goloka Vrindavan? Like, how are they connected?
The Nitya, the eternal Navadvipa,
and Goloka Vrindavan, and like, can devotees move between the two pastimes? Like
between
Goloka Vrindavan and
means between Vrindavan and Navadvipa.
Means
like catch a train or something, go over, see what's happening over. We heard Jashoda Mai was having a program. Want to go check it out?
If they had the Kaupian person, they had a desire to be in Navadvipa, like with Lord Chaitanya's pastime, Krishna Balaram, can they be move back and forth between the two, or is it generally that they...
But then if they move, then who will be there to do what they're doing? Krishna comes out to the Goshala, all the cows have gone to Navadvipa. Then has enough cows up for them?
So does it mean that those two realms exist with the devotees, like Lord Chaitanya is like in Nityananda, the same as Krishna is in Goloka Vrindavan, four pastimes are going on simultaneously?
Yes, they're both going on simultaneously. Like that, the devotees may be in both, it just means they're in both at the same time. No one has to catch a train and pull a car and go over there. You know, means look at it this way. Material world is how big? Right? We think it's very big, but it's like a mustard seed, you know, floating on the waters of the causal ocean. Right? And so Mahavishnu, he's one quarter of the cosmic creation. Right? So that three quarters, Goloka, is 51% of that. So that means bigger than Mahavishnu, right? So then the distance between them, how are they going to move? You know what I'm saying? No, it means, this is a questioning process. It means those little cogs between the ears are supposed to move. You know what I'm saying? It's your question. You're supposed to be thinking. Otherwise, how are you going to... I mean, it's fine. You want to ask the question and someone else understands it. That's fine, because then everybody else benefits by a question. But if you want to understand it, then you have to be thinking, not just smiling and nodding your head. Though it is nice etiquette and it's appreciated, but if you want to understand, then there has to be more going on than that. Do you understand it? So you're looking at it by time and space. There is no time and space in the spiritual world. There's the concept of it because it lends itself to the pastimes. So the point is that devotees can be at both places at once. They don't have to move from one to the other. Why would they move? Each one is so perfect. Why would they want to move from it? You understand? Does that make sense? Yeah.
But there's one pastime where, I don't know, I was just listening to one of the lectures where it's described Krishna Balaram, they went from Vrindavan to Navadvip. But is it just specific?
But do you hear of anybody else doing that? No, just they do that. But they're still in both places at once. It's just their pastime. So if God wants to do what he does, don't worry about it. That makes sense. Yeah. You know, they may create an element of linear, but it's only for taste, because they're simultaneous. Okay.
Excuse me, I just want to clarify on the 49. What I said in the I said we should not worship any other form of Krishna. Just only worship Krishna.
Yes.
No, Krishna is God.
Yes.
The reason we do it, because we cannot find, if we worship Krishna, we cannot find the liberation.
You won't find liberation. How do you get liberation? Why won't you get liberation?
We should not.
No, that's another thing. But the point of getting liberation, you know, Vishnu means any form of any Vishnu tattva can award a liberation. That's their position. But we're not looking for liberation, so it doesn't really come up as a discussion. You understand? We don't worship other forms as the goal of our worship. Right? Because then that is the way Krishna will reciprocate with you, and then you'll end up in that place, in that pastime. Right? So that's why the devotees of Lord Chaitanya only worship Krishna in Vrindavan. Right? So if there's any interaction with any other form, that's because Krishna has taken that form. And the point of worshipping is to develop love for Krishna. So there's no contradiction. But others who worship Vishnu as the supreme goal, then they'll go to a different place within the spiritual world. Does that make sense? Yeah. So since it's being offered to go to Braja, then one should take it. That's the recommendation. It's rare to get it. Does that make sense? Yeah. Something else? Yes. More faith in Krishna. The faith is gained originally by association with devotees. Right? It's by association with devotees that there's a jnata sukriti. That a jnata sukriti, when it becomes great by a certain volume, then one develops faith. Right? Because then the contact with Krishna consciousness is great enough that it catches one's attention. You know what I'm saying? But that jnata sukriti has been gained through devotees. It's devotees who created those opportunities for service. Right? They're doing the festivals, they're distributing prasad, they're doing going on Harinam, doing Rath Yatras, like that. And that way you're coming in contact with Krishna consciousness. Right? So, therefore, the process is the same. Faith is developed in the association with devotees. That's why Rupa Goswami recommends associating with those who are more advanced than yourself. Because by that association, then we... then we pick up the mood that they have at serving Krishna. Right? Is that okay? So in other words, you have reading, you can associate, you have personally associating, all these different aspects you take advantage of. Yes? So the key is the more than that, right? So just like, okay, that person has a family at home, right? So therefore, according to their philosophy, they never go and visit the broader family, right? They don't go visit their parents, or they don't go visit brothers and sisters, right? Yes or no? So they never go.
They go,
but why would they go? They already have family at home. Then they're contradicting their own philosophy. Why would you go visit family members? You have family at home. Right? It's the same reason if you have Krishna at home, but then you go see Krishna at the temple. There's more. Right? In other words, the family's there, but that expansion of it, the greatness of it, is by going and visiting other members of the family. So in the same way, by going to the temple, then you get more. Does that make sense? Yeah. So in other words, you use their same philosophy against them. What's happening? You were saying something? You're talking to someone. Oh, okay. Yeah, this whole dialogue's going on. Falling through the door. The whole scene's going on back there. Does that make sense? So in other words, just use your own philosophy against them. If they're going to be true to their philosophy, then they shouldn't go anywhere else. They shouldn't go to a restaurant because there's food at home. Right? Yeah. So then, you know, why would you go to a restaurant? Because there's food at home. There's family at home. There's food at home. There's troubles at home. Why go out for any more trouble? Right? Right? Is that okay? Yeah, still like that. You know, it's just, you just try that on them. Because they're thinking they're so smart. So you show them they're not actually very smart. Right? So either they'll have to agree to it if they're going to be true to their philosophy, or they'll have to actually reveal the real reason they don't want to go. Right. Something else? Yes. The point is these going through the levels of realization are only because that's how one would progress. If one can go directly, then why worry about the other ones? Like the gopis, they didn't bother with all the other, you know, intellectual elements. They just transferred their affection from, you know, whatever it might be, to Krishna. That's what you're trying to do. It's when that transference doesn't take place or only partially takes place, what hasn't taken place, that's where you use all this technical stuff. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you go to fix your tire on your car. You know, you just get out your wrench, everything comes off, you change it, fine. Now what happens when you go and the wrench doesn't work? Now you call the fancy guys that bring all the fancy machines and they make it work. You understand? So that's all. The point is develop love for Krishna. Then it's something you can do in the moment. If it takes you longer in the moment, then there's other techniques to help. Does that make sense? That's the idea. So in other words, we're bringing out these technical aspects so that devotees know that they're there. Otherwise, the sad thing is when devotees want to get technical about something, they go out and pick up some self-help book and say, now this is the latest thing that will make Krishna consciousness work nicely. And sadly to say, none of those books or none of those devotees that have used those books have ever made any significant change in the Krishna consciousness of the movement. Because those techniques are all part of our own. Just that they're very unscientific and incomplete and atheistic. Right? So Bhagavatam has all that technicality, but we're not looking there for it. Right? So if we want technical, Bhagavatam has it. We're not interested in technical, then we just stick to the more direct elements. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yes. You have to a little bit louder. Can you have a control of your desires? Why, you think someone else should be in control of them? Or you want someone else to control them? Or, I mean, that's all you got, so wouldn't it be good to hang on to it? How to change from Rasgula, what are you going to change to? Okay, well, we won't get into that. Okay. So, the point is that why do you like the Rasgula? It's nice, okay. The point is, but you're thinking that other things are not nice. So if you appreciate that other things are also nice, that same experience can be gained, then you can switch. Right? Does that make sense? Right? And especially if the rasgulas aren't good for you, then the benefit you get from them isn't so great. So do you actually enjoy yourself? Right? Take it over a long, let's take it over a 24-hour period. You ate the rasgula for 5 minutes. Now what about the other 23 hours and 55 minutes? Do you enjoy yourself? That goes bad for your health, and do you enjoy yourself? Yes, no? Yes. Means you're asking a very general question, so then the answer has to be somewhat general. Okay, let's say a person has diabetes, okay? And then if he eats the rasgula, then what happens? Right? All kinds of problems happen. So that means 5 minutes it was great, but then the rest of the day it's not so great. So if you think about it, then okay, then that's maybe it's not a source of enjoyment. So therefore find something else that's enjoyable. Does that make sense? So it's through intelligence you can switch. Or being attracted by something else more than that. So that's the whole point. Is Krishna performs this wonderful pastimes, they're more attractive than anything that goes on here. So that's the attractive element. And the philosophy of Krishna consciousness is there to explain everything so that by knowledge we can also try to adjust everything. Does that make sense? So between those two. Krishna fulfills the desire of the devotee. Yes. But you have to desire. What are you desiring more? The rasgula or to change from desire to rasgula? Which is more? You understand? Whichever is prominent, that's the one you get. So you really want to change, then that becomes prominent, and it moves that way. But if you just occasionally think about it, you know, that it would be nice, then how dynamic is that? Right? What you're absorbed in, that's the results you get. Okay? Sure? Okay. Yeah, that last point. Last question.
Yes. You're talking about what enhances faith.
Okay.
But also, how we see Krishna in some aspects of the material world, and that's how we can connect with Krishna without having to change anything. The question comes from where we put ourselves right in terms of our consciousness, trying to present Krishna consciousness in high place in circumstance for people so that they feel that our example or whatever we present up is relevant.
Right, because you start off what's above conditioning. If you want to preach to somebody who doesn't know about Krishna consciousness, you have to start from the position that's beyond conditioning. Right? Only the conditioning, in elements dealing with conditioning, that's where the doubts will come up. Right? But if you discuss beyond the conditioning, then where's the doubts? They don't have any experience there. Right? Does that make sense? So this element of the philosophy you're dealing on the transcendental level, most people don't deal with that at all. Even the Mayavadis don't really deal with the transcendental level because they say this is all illusion. But the point is, this is all the mind. So they're even not even really good Brahmavadis. Right? So you deal beyond that in the principles of Krishna consciousness, that they understand it and they have some appreciation of the philosophy. Right? And so then once that's there, then they can see that it works, it makes sense. Then you start to drop it into application of their conditioning. But if you start off with the conditioning directly, then there's all kinds of doubts. But in giving examples for discussing the pure philosophy, you use examples that they could relate to. That's your time, place, and circumstance. But this new idea of soft preaching where you start below and you don't really present Krishna consciousness, that's not actually preaching. You know? Like that, because where's the philosophy? They don't even know what's going on, who they are, or anything. You go beyond the conditioning. See, they have a problem because they go smack that into the conditioning. And so then it doesn't work. So then they say, well, you have to go below that. No, you have to go above it. You know what I'm saying? If something's in the way, you go over it. It's much easier than trying to go under it. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. So that is what the acharyas do. That's the real soft preaching. This other stuff, better to leave the word preaching out of the term. Just say soft. Because preaching means it gets effect. You know what I'm saying? Point is you can start off in a way that you're dealing with general philosophy. And then as it goes and they're convinced, then you bring it down and make it practical. But, you know, generally good preachers can do that within quite a short time. You know, so let's say by the end of the first time people coming in contact with, just give an example, then they're all chanting Hare Krishna and all this. Not that after 6 weeks of dealing, then you might introduce, after having introduced other mantras, dealing with Shiva and this one and that one, you might get a Hare Krishna. That's not soft preaching. That's just lack of faith. That's being embarrassed by our philosophy. In other words, they don't know enough philosophy, so they're embarrassed. You know, not wanting to present Krishna consciousness means they're embarrassed. That's all. So you're not actually dealing with the person's conditioning, you're dealing with your own. Because soft preaching means you don't worry, you don't have a problem about your own position. You're simply trying to present pure Krishna consciousness so that this other person can appreciate it in the context of their life. Right. And principles, everybody understands. You can teach them to a kid, you can teach them karma. There's no barrier to principles. The problem is much of the time devotees can't tell what a principle is. Like that.
sometimes the cliche or paradigm that's being presented of Christian consciousness in terms of faith as an Indian presentation.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is kind of, and if that's like translated into the West, for example.
But what does it mean? It's just like here. But they have a hang up about it, but let's just be really blunt here. I mean, like, really in your face blunt. Okay, now let us take a cross section of the whites here in this country. Now, there'll be a lot of them that are poor. A lot of whites here might be not so wealthy, right? But now, let us take the Asians. Now, for the proportion of Asians that are here, how many of them are poor? In proportion. So that means technically in the Western scenario, the Asians are way more successful per capita than the whites are. So what's this problem that the principles that they follow in their lifestyle don't work around the world? Because it's not just here. They're doing it in Australia. They're doing it in America, they're doing it in London, they're doing it in Europe. Wherever they go, they're successful. Why? Because they're basing it on whatever's left of the Indian culture. So if that was really the anxiety, then if one really wanted to be successful, one would take it up, because the Indians all over the world, they own everything. They're not renting. They own it. That house, they own it. The white guy, he's renting. In Mayapur, all the Indians, all the properties, they own it. And the Westerners come there and rent. And somehow or another, the Indian culture is that narrow-minded little thing that only applies there, kind of in an archaic way in India. But those Indians are going all over the world and being successful. Even their crazy, stupid movies and their dancing has a position in world dance and world cinema. Why? Because of the personal element. And the Western is failing because of the impersonal. So even you want to take that line that it's Indian, the whole point is they're a whole lot more successful per capita than anybody else on the planet. You know what I'm saying? The Gujus went into the diamond market in, you know, where is it? Where is that? Rotterdam or something in Holland, and they've taken over from the Jews. Jews have been in control of it for hundreds of years. They came in and within 20 years took over. Now that's successful. All the motels in America are owned by the Patels. So they must be doing something right. So then why aren't the whiteies wanting to know what's going on in India? So all this talk about, oh, we're Westerners, and that. And then what are you eating as Westerners? You know, do you eat the local Maori food? That's the local food here. If we're in New Zealand, the real food for right here is what the Maoris, is that what you're doing? Right? No. Like, you're eating pizza, where's that from? Italy. And where is that? It's a tropical place. More subtropical. Mediterranean. What about, Mexican? You know, that's also a similar kind of place. What about Chinese? There's a good chance you're not eating the northern part because they don't cook very good. You're eating the southern cooking where it's more tropical. And so somehow or another, all these different things are all coming from all around the world. They're making it all. The Chinese make everything. Everybody else makes everything. But somehow the whitey's sitting around and going, oh, it's Indian. It's one of the biggest jokes on the planet. You know what I'm saying? So therefore, if we want to get, xenophobic here, then great, let's get xenophobic and then figure out really what works. But the point is give it another 10, 20 years. I mean, in America, in some parts of America, the whites in the school can actually form a minority club. Well, before they couldn't. Now they can. America, you don't speak Spanish, you don't do so well. America's bilingual. When I was a kid, there was no question. It was only English. It was no other language. It's bilingual now. So everybody else is taking over. 1 in 4 in New York is Indian. 1 in 4. So, you know, just take that demographic and shoot it ahead, you know, 20, 30, 50 years. And then see, you know, because the rest of the world doesn't mind having kids. It's the white people that don't like having kids. So then who's going to be the majority? You know what I'm saying? So the point is these are basically clever tricks by academics. Right? Where is this coming from? Because this was never there before. It's something that came up basically starting in the 90s, and that when devotees got involved in academics. Is that if you reduce Vedic down to just Indian, then Indian's just another country, and then why India, why not America? That's the logic that they're trying to do. But why do we have to follow Indian culture? We're Americans. But what does American mean? Are they going out and riding around on the horses and shooting buffaloes? That's what actual local Americans did. They're Europeans, you know, or some other place. Right? So this whole idea is that it only fits here is nonsense. You know? It's nonsense. So it's just a way to maintain attachment to one's own culture that one's grown up in. That's all. It's not actually a scientific point. Because the point is any country of the world, anybody from anywhere else in the world can go there and with time adjust and function in the area. It's not exclusive that, you know, only in, you know, traditionally Western places, only Westerners prosper and everybody else just kind of like is around the fringe. Does that make sense? So it's a bogus approach, but it comes from the academics like that. So that's why Prabhupada was very careful about modern academia, because they see things from such mundane perspectives. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Sorry that was too blunt, but hey. Okay, so and now I think it's time for the shot. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Dadai Gaurava.